Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University School of Public Health titled Modern Day Debtors' Prisons, Race and Revenue Generation in Courts Across America. Our speaker is Nusrat Chowdhury, Deputy Director of the ACLU Racial Justice Program. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Dr. Sandro Galea, Dean of the School of Public Health.
Today's topic is something that I think is critically important to the health of populations. In 1833, the U.S. ended the practice of imprisoning debtors under federal law, but two centuries later, we continue to jail people, predominantly low-income persons of color, for being unable to pay legal debts. This reflects the intersection of three issues that are at the heart of what we talk about at the school: race, mass incarceration, and economic inequity. The confluence of forces produces poor health, making it of acute concern to anybody interested in the health of the public. I think there are few people in the country better qualified to discuss this challenge than today's speaker. Nusrat Chowdhury is Deputy Director of the American Civil Liberties Union Racial Justice Program. In this role, she leads litigation challenging racial profiling and the illegal arrest and jailing of people who cannot pay the courts. Her work has exposed and reformed practices in a number of states, has led to the development of national guidance for creating a fairer system. She is the recipient of the South Asian Bar Association of New York Access to Justice Award, the Edward Beller Distinguished Alumnus Award of Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School, and the Paul and Daisy Soros Fellowship for New Americans. I'm really delighted to have Nusrat Chowdhury at our school. Welcome. Looking forward to learning from you.
Thank you so much, Dean Galea, Rafiq, all of the students and staff of the school that I've spoken to today. It's an honor to be here at the Boston University School of Public Health. And as I remarked to the dean earlier today, I think it is such a testament to this community to even have a conversation about the criminalization of poor people of color in our legal system and how that is foundational to health, as the dean just mentioned. At the ACLU, as many of you know, we are the country and the world's largest public interest legal and advocacy organization. We have offices that serve the country and every state in the United States, as well as Puerto Rico. And we use as our tools litigation, advocacy, and organizing to make change that will realize the promises of our Constitution and federal laws. And two of those core promises are fairness in our court system and equal treatment of rich and poor, both of which are core principles violated by the problem of what we're talking about today, what are essentially modern-day debtors' prisons. The locking up of people, the deprivation of their liberty simply because they do not have money to pay courts. And concomitant with that, and at the root of that, is, of course, white supremacy and racism. So the ACLU Racial Justice Program, which is part of the national office, is a team of people who seek to affirm the dignity of people of color, to fight white supremacy and racism, and to dismantle the drivers of racial inequality in our society. And we think that this issue, the criminalization of people who simply cannot pay money in the legal system, hits each of those issues. The roots of this problem lie in white supremacy and racism, and it is definitely a driver of inequality, including inequalities in health outcomes, as we're talking about here in a school of public health. The Constitution, as I said, promises a justice system that is fair and provides equal treatment to rich and poor. And those promises are embedded in the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. That amendment was passed in the aftermath of the Civil War, as Northern liberals watched in horror as state after state in the American South, which had lost the Civil War, which was fought over slavery, sought to reassert racial hierarchy by instituting slavery by another name. And I'll talk more about this later today. But basically, after the Civil War was lost, we saw state after state passing laws that enabled the easy arrest and incarceration of black people in the American South as a way of coercing them to perform forced labor when they couldn't pay fines and fees for those offenses like vagrancy. You see this kind of sweeping passage of laws across the American South for things that shouldn't even be criminalized in order to bring back slavery by another name. And what the U.S. Congress did at the time was discuss extensively an amendment to help push back against this. And that's where we, as all Americans, get our rights to due process and equal treatment of the rich and poor. That is a right created out of the understanding that our Constitution needed to guard against racial hierarchy. And I think that promise is so important because it underscores that the fight for racial justice is actually about improving our country for all of us. And it also underscores that the deprivation of due process and equal protection, those promises embedded in the 14th Amendment today, the roots of that deprivation lie in this country's history of racial subjugation and hierarchy of Black Americans and Native peoples. So these are concepts that can be heavy, but I think really this is about much more than words and concepts. It's about a lived reality. And there's no better illustration of that lived reality than the story of Tawanda Marchinda Brown. Shinda, as her family and friends call her, is a mother. Her seven children are, in her words, the light of her life. From her eldest, Rashan, who had his own son a few years ago, to her youngest son, Dakari, who is now 15. Shinda used to live on the outskirts of Columbia, South Carolina, where two counties, Richland County and Lexington County, meet. Both counties have been facing rising poverty since 2012, with Black and Latinx people hit more than twice as hard as white people. Lexington County is one of the richest counties in South Carolina and is also the home of Dylann Roof, the 21-year-old white supremacist who in 2015 committed one of the most horrific acts of our time, the murder of nine Black people who were worshiping at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston. In 2016, Shinda was struggling to support herself and her kids by working at a Burger King franchise, and the franchise wasn't doing that well. More importantly, it was also not treating its employees right. Each week when the franchise would cut its paychecks, employees would go to the bank to cash those paychecks, and they would discover that the paychecks would bounce. Sometimes the managers would get paid first so that their paychecks would clear, but the employees who would get there after their shifts often went there and found that their checks wouldn't clear. So they actually didn't get paid for the labor that they had done. And Shinda was one of these employees. She needed this job at Burger King, though, because it was the job that would help her support herself and her kids. And she was a primary breadwinner for her family. She was a sole breadwinner for her family. Some of her older kids were able to work, but she was the principal person responsible. So Shinda got two traffic tickets when driving one day in county. She was actually driving a coworker home who needed a ride, and Shinda knew she shouldn't be driving because her driver's license was suspended for unpaid traffic tickets. So she got caught. She got two traffic tickets, one for driving on a suspended license and one for having a tag light that was expired. But Shinda is a person who wants to make things right. Shinda went to court. She said, "I did something wrong. I need to fix this problem." When she went there, there was no one in court to help her. There were no public defenders in court representing people in their cases. In fact, instead, when she got to court, someone handed her a piece of paper and said, "Oh, check off the boxes." And she said, "I don't know what this means." And they said, "Well, you have to fill it out." So she looked at the form, didn't understand what it meant. She saw that what one thing it did say was, if you want a lawyer, you have to pay a $40 non-refundable fee. Well, she didn't have a $40 non-refundable fee. So she checked off a box that said, no lawyer. She then handed the form to the judge, and the judge said, okay, so you're pleading guilty, you don't want a lawyer, I'm sentencing you to pay $2,400. Two traffic tickets. $2,400. A really good question to ask is, why is the fine for two traffic tickets $2,400 in the first place? These fines are some of the highest fines we've seen for comparable traffic violations anywhere in the country. And one thing is worth noting is that the fines and fees collected by the court that Shinda went to helped generate revenue for Lexington County, South Carolina, which, as I mentioned, is one of the wealthiest counties in South Carolina. So, question mark, why are fines and fees for low-level traffic offenses so high? Shinda nevertheless told the court, I can't afford to pay $2,400, but I want to do what's right. I can pay something. I can't pay $2,400. The judge then ordered her to pay, on a payment plan, $100 each month, and also imposed a 3% collection fee because she was paying on a payment plan rather than all at once. Shinda explained she could not pay for $100 a month. She just couldn't do it. She said, I can pay $50 a month. The judge responded, I don't care if you have one, two, three, four, five, six, or seven kids. I want my money, and I want my money on the 12th. If you miss one payment, there will be a warrant out for your arrest. The judge never asked Shinda about her financial situation. The judge never asked her who she was financially responsible for, nor did the judge ever ask how much she earned at her job at Burger King. Nor did the judge ever ask or learn that Shinda was doing work but wasn't getting paid on time through no fault of her own. Shinda left court terrified about what was going to happen. She knew she couldn't afford $100 a month, and she remembers so vividly that the judge said, I want my money, and I want my money on the 12th, and if I don't get my money, there will be a warrant out for your arrest. Shinda struggled, and she paid as much as she could. She made five payments, which in and of itself, given her financial situation, was Herculean. But her paychecks from Burger King kept bouncing, and then her son had a workplace accident, which meant he had to get surgery on his jaw, and she couldn't work while taking care of him. So she just couldn't keep the balancing act together anymore. She missed a payment, and she was terrified. She knew what was going to happen. She wanted to go to court, but she kept remembering the judge's words. If you miss a payment, there'll be a warrant for your arrest. She was worried if she went to court, she would get arrested on the spot. So Shinda pounded the pavement and tried to find a new job. She finally found one at a food processing plant. She just needed to get to the first paycheck so she could start paying the court again. She thought, if I can just work until I get that first paycheck and make a payment, the court will see that I'm trying to do the right thing. She does so well in her first 2 weeks of work that she already was offered a promotion, which would come with it a raise. She had started as a temporary employee, and she was doing so fantastically that they said, we're going to make you permanent and give you a promotion, and that's going to come with a raise. And so she was thinking, this is going to work out. She goes home on a Friday night. She's supposed to get paid on Monday. Saturday morning, her son comes into her room and says, Mama, the sheriff is out there. She puts on her clothes. She goes to the front door. Two sheriff's deputies come in. She sent her son out to take the trash because she knew what was going to happen. And she didn't want him to see her get handcuffed and taken to jail. So she sends Dakari out to go take out the trash. And she does get handcuffed. She gets taken to a police car. And she gets taken to jail. She's first taken to Richland County. After a couple days, they transfer her to Lexington County. No one has really explained to her what's going on, but she knows it has something to do with the fact that she missed payments to the court. And finally, when they take her to the Lexington County Jail and they book her, they give her a piece of paper. And that piece of paper is a warrant. It says, you're required to pay $1,907.63, the entire amount owed for your traffic ticket, or to serve 90 days in jail. That wasn't a real choice. That was a jail sentence on a piece of paper. Shinda had no one in her life who could give her that kind of money on the spot. She was living paycheck to paycheck, barely getting paid, and hadn't even gotten the first paycheck at this new job. So she knew what was going to happen. She was jailed for 57 days. And during those 57 days, the impact on her and her family was nothing short of devastating. She could not call her job to tell them what happened to her, so they didn't know. And she lost her job. Her 13-year-old son, Dakari, was still in school. He learned his mom had been jailed. she couldn't get out to be with him. And he's a minor. So every day she lived with the fear that the Department of Child Services was going to come and take her child away. She spent her 40th birthday in jail. She had a cousin who died. She could not be with her family. The emotional and physical toll of jail gave her migraines and headaches and sleeplessness, which here in this community of people who are thinking deeply about public health is a real shock and trauma that has lasting impacts, both immediate impacts and lasting impacts on a human being. She was lucky, quote, air quotes, in the sense that her older children were able to care for Dakari so that he wasn't taken to child welfare services and removed from her custody permanently, which was a very real threat. But the impact on Dakari is something that we should all be thinking about, too. He wrote his mother a letter for her 40th birthday, which she spent in jail, as I mentioned, and he wrote about how much he missed her and couldn't wait to see her. And he wrote that he was doing kind of good, but things were really hard. And I'm going to quote, I'm going to read what he wrote, which I just find so hard to read because it's so visceral and real. He wrote, what I mean by that, Mom, is that I've been getting in some trouble when you've been gone. It seems to me that it's better when you're here. You put clothes on my back and a roof over my head. My heart is full of memories. Though life goes on without you, it will never be the same without you. This is real. 57 days in jail for not having money. The impact on Shinda, on her son, on her family, on her employer, on the entire community, from treating her like an ATM rather than a person who deserves justice and the chance to pay her debt to society without having it derail her life. This is what her story shows, and I think I could tell you dozens of more stories of people just like Shinda. You know, in the lawsuit that we brought for Shinda, she is not the only single mother of color who was separated from her children for months because she couldn't pay money to the court system. When we talk about family separation, we're talking not just about the horror of families being ripped at the border of the United States. We are talking about the terror that children feel when they lose their parents to the criminal legal system. And that trauma is real for her and her son and her entire family. They still talk about that period, even though in the last 2 years their lives have gotten better, and I'll talk more about that later. And South Carolina is far from the only place that is running a debtor's prison like the one that jailed Shinda for 57 days when she didn't have money to pay a court. In 2010, the ACLU exposed modern-day debtor's prisons in a landmark report called In for a Penny, The Rise of America's Modern-Day Debtor's Prisons. And we mapped this practice in Ohio, Washington, Louisiana, Michigan, and Georgia. And since then, we've exposed debtors' prisons in additional 10 states. So that's 17 states total now. We have brought since 2015 five large impact lawsuits in Georgia, Mississippi, Washington, Arkansas, North Carolina. They challenge different forms of punishing people because they don't have money to pay courts. Most of those cases challenged debtors' prisons, systems where people were jailed when they couldn't pay money on a traffic ticket or for another low-level violation. All of the other cases we have filed challenging debtors' prisons under the Constitution settled within 6 months because the defendants in those cases, which were city and county governments, didn't want to be on the wrong side of a lawsuit that told stories like Shinda's. Instead, what they said is, we want to be a part of the solution. Let's engage in some reform. But the debtors' prisons in Lexington County is the worst I have encountered in doing this work for 5 years. And the defendants in that case have not settled. The defendants in that case instead spent a year and a half trying to kick this case out of court using every legal argument they possibly could. They filed 3 separate summary judgment motions, making different arguments about why the case just shouldn't be heard in a court. It just shouldn't be brought. Their argument wasn't, this practice is okay. The argument was, the federal courts should not hear this kind of case. We won on those motions in the federal district court, and we argued on appeal in December before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, which permitted the case to go forward. And I think Shinda's story helped show why it should. And Shinda wasn't alone. As I mentioned, we actually looked at court records and jail records in Lexington County in investigating the suit, and we saw that each year, in the 1 year before Shinda was illegally jailed, there were 1,000 people at risk of being arrested and jailed on a bench warrant that say, pay X amount of money or else serve Y days in jail. None of these people got a court hearing before that happened. None of them got access to a lawyer. No one had anyone helping them make their case to the court. Listen, I shouldn't be punished with jail. I didn't pay my fine, not because it was intentional, but because I simply don't have the money to pay. Can I have some kind of alternative? And this is actually what the Constitution requires. In a 1983 seminal Supreme Court decision called Bearden versus Georgia, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a decision by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, held that a court can't jail you just because you don't pay money that you owe. You have to get the chance to explain yourself and give reasons. And if those reasons are that you just can't pay, the court needs to think about alternatives that make sense, like reducing the amount you have to pay to something you can manage, like giving you an extended period of time to pay, or community service, or something else that will fulfill the obligation of the state court system to make sure that people comply with their legal obligations. But that decision in 1983 hasn't been respected. And I think this goes back to what I started with about the ongoing racial systems of injustice in this country. Like, why is it that 1,000 people were at risk of being unlawfully jailed in Lexington County before we filed this lawsuit in one of the wealthiest counties in South Carolina where there are high rates of poverty, particularly amongst Black and Latinx people? And I think the answer is because these are populations that are easily sidelined, they are not politically powerful, and they're easily targeted by practices that seek to generate revenue on the backs of poor people. But that's what's happening in these communities across the country. And I think the country became aware of this problem after the terrible events in Ferguson and community protests led to a U.S. Department of Justice investigation and report that found that the city of Ferguson's municipal court was treating its people like ATM machines, particularly its Black community, turning to them for revenue generation rather than thinking about them as communities that deserve public safety like everybody else. Jailing people when they couldn't pay parking tickets, fining people extra when they were homeless and couldn't appear in court because they never got notice that they had a court date in the first place. These sorts of cyclical systems. And this is exactly what we're challenging in these 17 states across the country. These are blatantly unconstitutional practices. Yet what we need is litigation and advocacy and organizing to make sure that the government respects these core constitutional rights. Now, jail is just one of the draconian sanctions that we see imposed on people who can't pay money to the legal system. Driver's license suspensions are ubiquitous and can construct a debtor's prison without using bars. Across the country, state governments have stripped 11 million people of their driver's licenses for failure to pay a fine or a fee to a court. 44 states and the District of Columbia suspend or revoke a driver's license if a person has failed to pay court fines or fees. Frequently, licenses are taken away without any procedural protections, like notice that this is about to happen, or that you can ask for or get a hearing on your financial circumstances, or the consideration of alternatives to taking away your license suspension. But in most places, A license is necessary to travel to and from work, find a job, access health care, and take your kids to school, to care for loved ones, to go to the pharmacy, to do your groceries. In places like North Carolina, it is virtually impossible to do these things if you don't have a driver's license. This is a state that's predominantly rural with minimal public transportation, as the state itself has acknowledged in numerous reports about access to public transportation. North Carolina has a law that requires the automatic suspension of a license when someone is reported for not paying a traffic ticket. So automatically, if your payment doesn't come in, your license is suspended. And that suspension is indefinite until you pay the fines. So for a person who can't pay, North Carolina statute imposes an inescapable and permanent suspension. You're too poor to pay, so your license gets suspended. But because your license is suspended, you can't drive without violating the law, risking additional tickets and fines and even jail time. What do you do when you're too poor to pay a traffic ticket? Do you take money away from your rent to pay the ticket because you're worried that if your license is suspended, then you might have to drive illegally to get to work and you'll face additional traffic tickets and maybe jail time? Like, what do you do? So this is impossible. This is an impossible choice. It's not a choice. It's an impossible situation. And this is a debtor's prison of a different kind. We filed a lawsuit against North Carolina statute on behalf of Seti Johnson and others who were victims of the scheme. More than 400,000 people in North Carolina do not have a North Carolina driver's license because they couldn't pay a traffic ticket. And Seti Johnson and the other plaintiffs in the case represent the tens of thousands of people who are probably currently on the rolls, can't pay their tickets, and are trapped, essentially, in a wealth-based license suspension scheme. So Seti's case, I think, is an important one as well, just like Shinda's. He had to choose between paying his traffic tickets and supporting his kids. He was stopped in a routine traffic stop around 2 years ago in North Carolina, and that was the first time he even learned that his license was suspended for previously not being able to pay a traffic ticket. So he stopped in a traffic stop, learns that his license is suspended, and at the time he was unemployed but looking for work. He needed to drive. So when he discovered the license was suspended, he knew he needed to do something to get the license back. So he didn't pay his rent, and instead put that money paying the traffic ticket that led to the original suspension. That traffic ticket carried around more than $700 in fines and fees. So he basically takes the rent money, pays off the original traffic ticket, and gets his suspension lifted. But the problem is that traffic stop that led him to discover his license was suspended led to another ticket for driving on a suspended license. This is how it's a cyclical issue. Another ticket with another set of fines and fees that he couldn't pay. So he's then facing the exact same situation again. What do I do? I need this car to take care of my kids and to keep looking for work because I'm unemployed, which is why I couldn't pay the last traffic ticket, but I'm still trying to look for work because I don't want to not be able to pay traffic tickets. We represent him in a class action suit against this North Carolina statute that requires automatic, indefinite suspension when you can't pay traffic tickets. And just like the jailing of Shinda Brown, this violates core promises of fairness and equal treatment of rich and poor. A person who can pay a traffic ticket never gets a license suspension in South Carolina. You don't get a license suspension for failure to pay traffic tickets because you could pay. But a person who can't is trapped in this system forever. The district court in the case granted class certification, so said yes, Mr. Johnson can represent a class of similarly situated people, but said that this is not wealth-based punishment. This is a rational way to collect debts owed to the state. So we appealed. This summer, we submitted briefs to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit with our partners at the Southern Poverty Law Center, the ACLU of North Carolina, and the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. And our appeal argues that this is wealth-based punishment. This is exactly the kind of practice that the Supreme Court has guarded against in a line of cases, including Bearden versus Georgia and others, and that this is actually far from rational because you make it harder to collect money from people when you take away the license they need to be able to drive, to get to work, to find work, and to make sure people can take care of themselves and their families. There is such a strong and direct link between driver's licenses and economic livelihood that conservative, right-leaning groups have weighed in. Last week, we launched a campaign called the Free to Drive National Campaign. It is supported by 100 organizations ranging the ideological spectrum from the American Civil Liberties Union to Americans for Prosperity. This year, we also passed a statute with Americans for Prosperity and others in a coalition ending wealth-based license suspensions in the state of Montana because business owners understand that it hurts the economy to deprive people of the only way they have of getting to and from work. So there is momentum here. This is not just a left issue. This is an issue that everyone understands is hurting families and individuals and entire economies in a way that is unjust and racialized. So I see promise in what we're doing. We are calling out these systems as focusing on revenue generation at the expense of people's rights. When we talk about these stories, when we highlight the impact, we talk about race and we talk about who is feeling the pain. And the pain is racialized in America. The ACLU is not stopping with these two lawsuits. We are poised to bring even more litigation in more states against wealth-based punishments. We also filed a lawsuit recently in Florida against the attempt to roll back voting rights restoration on people's inability to pay court fines and fees related to felony convictions. That case is also being litigated and is also raising similar arguments under the due process and equal protection clauses of the Constitution. And our effort has gained even more steam since last February, when the U.S. Supreme Court issued a rare, unanimous opinion in the case of Timms versus Indiana. This is a case that involved the Eighth Amendment's excessive fines clause. And what the Supreme Court technically held was that the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against the imposition of excessive fines applies to state and local governments, not just to the federal government. And that was kind of a technical legal issue that had never been resolved before. There was always a question about whether the 14th Amendment's the Bill of Rights extend to all of the states and local governments or whether it only applies to the federal government. And the Supreme Court held that, yes, in fact, this part of the Eighth Amendment does apply to state and local governments. But what is so striking about the opinion is that it was unanimous. And I think we all know how rare that is in America today. And in separate opinions, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Justice Clarence Thomas acknowledged the critical historical context for modern-day protection against debtors' prisons. And that's the context that I started with. Southern states' abusive use of fines to enforce white supremacy in the years following the Civil War. And I just want to let that sink in. Justice Ginsburg and Justice Thomas both wrote opinions talking about how fines were used as a tool of subjugating black people after the Civil War. And that's one of the reasons why our Constitution protects against excessive and abusive fines and fees. And Justice Ginsburg's opinion even acknowledged and cited an amicus brief written by the American Civil Liberties Union explaining that one of the reasons we have this protection is because revenue generation incentives can obviously lead to abuse. But both justices described how Southern states enacted black codes after the Civil War to subjugate newly freed slaves. Those laws permitted the imposition of huge fines, fines as high as $500 in the 1860s. So if we think $500 is high now, which it is, because most Americans cannot cover a $400 emergency expense, imagine how high a $500 fine was in the 1860s. And for things like vagrancy, $500 for vagrancy. And I think what their opinions underscore is that this sordid history of abusive use of courts to generate revenue and as a way of enforcing racial hierarchy was not just a part of our past, but it's omnipresent. And so it's part of why we have to fight for the protections that we fight for today, and is why it's important to ground them in the Constitution, because that's why we have these rights in the first place. But this isn't just a story about problems. I want to end with another story about solutions, in addition to the Montana win, in addition to this like coalition that is bringing together left and right. We have achieved remarkable successes. One of our biggest successes is out of Biloxi, Mississippi, which is in the heart of the Deep South. Biloxi is actually where Jefferson David, who was the president of the Confederacy, is from. So there is a home that is a memorial to Jefferson Davis in the city of Biloxi. And not far from that home is the jail, the Harrison County Jail, where we found many people were incarcerated in 2015 because they couldn't pay fines and fees to the court. But after we filed a suit against Biloxi, the city took, as I mentioned, a radically different approach than what we're seeing in South Carolina. The city called us and said, we want to be a part of the solution. We want to create a model for what Mississippi cities should do to treat people fairly and to run a rational and common sense court system. And they worked with us really hard to come up with a set of reforms that makes their court system better. And what that involved was abolishing the use of for-profit companies to collect money, because those companies were not serving people or the public. They were serving their own bottom lines and using coercive tactics to collect debts. It involved establishing a public defender's office so that now, today, there was always a person standing next to someone who was reported for not having paid a fine or completed community service, so that people have the help of a lawyer when they're facing jail. It included court procedures, a bench card, things to guide and train judges on what the law is, how to respect constitutional rights, and how to determine someone's ability to pay. What is the standard you use? What are the questions you ask? How do you document this so that you know you're treating people well and fairly? And that deserves really kind of taking stock of. Like, this was done in the heart of the Deep South. We've uncovered debtors' prisons in Washington, one of the bluest states in the country, where the reforms aren't this good. If Biloxi can do this, every jurisdiction in America can do this, both because it is right and because it makes sense, because punishing people simply does not help public safety or make it any more likely that people are going to be able to pay money they simply don't have. And based on that settlement, we were able to advocate with the Supreme Court of Mississippi to amend their court rules to also institute protections like requiring a hearing before someone is facing jail when they can't pay a fine, like making sure there's a standard for determining ability to pay. And that court rule then led to the passage of a state law which does the same thing. So here we have one jurisdiction that took a courageous turn towards reform and helped us work towards statewide change in all of Mississippi. So now some of the reforms in Mississippi are stronger than what we have in far, far bluer states across the country. So I think what this shows is that when we do this work to dismantle wealth-based punishment in the legal system, when we do it with a way that centers the stories of people who are impacted, which explains that they are people who simply need respect for their human dignity, when we show that the court is not served, and nor is the public served, by practices that simply punish people for being poor, we can actually transform courts, we can transform entire state systems, and we can improve people's lives. And that's why we do what we do at the ACLU. We know that there's no one case that will solve this problem. There's no one law. There's no one reform. But it's part of all of these things coming together, litigation, community organizing, advocacy at the legislature, to make sure that the constitutional promises we already have are realized and that we get more of them to cover the newer punishments like license suspensions, so it's clear that they also fly in the face of our promises of due process and equal protection for rich and poor. So I just thank you all as public health advocates, part of the public health community, and in acknowledging and thinking through how criminalization of poverty by the court system is deeply impacting people's well-being and their overall health outcomes. And I think the stories of the people that we tell deeply show that that is indeed the case. And what I'm looking forward to is a conversation about how you are thinking about this issue and what you can do as well to play a role as a force for change. Thank you.
Hi, can you tell us about Shanda? You said you were going to tell us.
About Shanda. So I will tell you. I mean, she is so remarkable. So after she was released from jail, we met her in jail. You know, I looked at the court records, and I had a suspicion she was jailed just because she couldn't pay. So when I met her in jail, it was devastating. She was just devastated. Her eyes were literally red from crying every day for her son. And when she finally got out, she was relieved to be out, but she didn't have a job. So it was a very desperate situation. She almost lost her home. It was very, very hard for her to make ends meet. And it took her about 4 or 5 months to find a new job, and it was not a good job. Her previous job was much better, working in the food processing company. This was a retail clothing job. It didn't give enough hours. It was not enough money to make ends meet. And eventually, you know, she wouldn't stop. And she filed this lawsuit. She knew that justice comes late to people in this country who fight to enforce their rights. And in the meantime, she ended up getting a job in construction. So she was doing hard work. She was out there doing construction on streets in South Carolina, in the South Carolina heat. You know, she wore a vest and a hat. And while they were doing road construction, but it paid much better. And she was able to pay off a lot of her debts, pay off a lot of those underlying traffic tickets that led to her license being suspended. And she now lives in North Carolina doing that work and is doing much better.
Hi, I was very fortunate recently to visit one of the public defender offices in Alabama, where this is a very serious problem, which is my home state. I want to know, what is it that determines how a state gets different public defender offices? Because Alabama only has three, Montgomery, Birmingham, and in Tuscaloosa, which is my hometown. But in North Alabama and South Alabama, there is no public defender office. And then I want to know what I can do to help with this problem.
That's a great question. So from what I understand about Alabama, every state has its own system for public defense. The Supreme Court held in a very landmark decision in Gideon versus Rainwright that there's a right to counsel in the criminal process. And in subsequent cases, it has made clear you have a right to an attorney when you're facing incarceration, whether it's immediate or suspended in the future. And so it's a really good question about how are you going to realize that right? How are you going to make sure there are attorneys to represent people who can't pay for a lawyer but have a constitutional right to being defended by a lawyer before facing this huge punishment of immediate or suspended incarceration? So in Alabama, my understanding is it's left to the counties. And we don't love it. We don't love it ever when there's a county-based public defender system rather than a state public defender system, because then it's up to each individual county how they want to do it. And my understanding about Alabama, which is similar to some of the other states, is that certain counties have created like a public defender office, while other counties have a panel of attorneys who are private attorneys and then get appointed to specific criminal cases. And there are obvious problems with that. I mean, what we tend to see in places where it's a system, a volunteer appointment, essentially, the compensation rates are really low. The attorneys aren't kind of filing as many motions to do as vigorous a defense of the people they're representing, and it's a problem. I will also say I've seen public defender's offices who are not fighting very hard for their clients either, and I've seen public defender's office who will go to the bat, and they will just fight like you wouldn't believe. So reforming public defender systems is a very important and huge part of what the ACLU does. I know some of our allies are really involved in that fight too. And part of one of the arguments in Shinda's case, she's bringing these due process, equal protection arguments. She also has a Sixth Amendment claim saying that the public defender in Lexington County is not providing public defense because that office only asks for and only gets half of the money, half the amount of money that a comparably sized county is asking for and getting. So what that means is that public defender's office is not really worrying about a lot of these low-level cases, even though they have draconian circumstances. Because if you look at a different county, like Spartanburg County in South Carolina, same number of people, relatively same size docket, their public defender's office asks for and gets twice as much money. Their defenders are more likely to be in court. They're more likely to be in jail. Why did no one ever talk to Shinda in jail? Why was it that it was me and my colleagues who were the first people to talk to these people who had been in jail for weeks without ever talking to a lawyer? And your question is so great because it underscores that the right to counsel is such a critical part of the solution. And again, it's already required under the Constitution. The question is, how do we get states and county governments to live up to that promise? And it's a really tough nut to crack because public defenders cost money. That's why I think it's worth underscoring that Biloxi did the right thing. Biloxi said, we're not going to fight the lawsuit. We're going to create a public defender system because we understand that these courts are going to help the judge do the judge's job because the judge has a lot to think about. And that's the purpose of a lawyer, is to help the judge know what to do and do it the right way and push back when it's not done the right way so that the individual gets justice.
Hi, thanks very much for that. I really appreciate how you ended with a message of, I guess, hope and progress on this issue. I just wanted to ask about the kind of increased rate of judicial appointments under the current administration and whether you felt if and how this might affect your rate of progress moving forward.
Yes. It's not good. I mean, we are concerned that the type of people being appointed to the federal bench are of an ideological bent and with a lack of rigor in their credentials to be a federal judge with lifetime appointment, and that is going to impact civil rights litigation across the country. So we do think about where do we bring the cases. We look at who's on the bench. And it's a reality. It's always been a reality in the United States, and it's kind of gone in waves. And so there have been times, for example, in the Obama administration where there are certain parts of the country that had really hostile courts, courts that were very hostile to civil rights litigation because folks on those benches were appointed by people of a different political party. So I would say that, like, things are also highly variable. And like I mentioned, you know, change takes a long time in the courts, and it's just one part of the struggle. So if we can't bring litigation due to some of these real issues, there has to be another way. The solution is not stop enforcing constitutional rights. It's forcing us to be more creative in thinking about how we push constitutional rights.
First of all, thank you. That was terrific. Can you educate us about the global example? What other countries do you look to that we can learn from about sort of looking at long-term solutions?
Yeah. Thank you. Such a good question. So someone asked, one of the students asked earlier during lunch, you know, what about other countries? And we talked a little bit about Australia. I actually want to point us to Europe. Europe doesn't have modern-day debtors' prisons for many reasons. They don't use fines to generate revenue for governments. They generate revenue by imposing taxes. And so you don't see this huge ballooning in reliance on court revenue to fund governments and to fund the court system itself. So the monetary penalties imposed in Europe are of a magnitude different than what you see in the United States. In a lot of European countries, you see a concept called day fines. It's a kind of catchphrase for proportional fines. income-adjusted fines. So you'll see a fine for an offense where the offense gravity is given like a point system. Say, you know, there could be an offense that has 10 points versus an offense that has 2 points, given how serious the offense is. And then the point value is multiplied by how much money a person earns in a day. And it's a way of making sure that the fine imposed imparts a punishment that fits the crime and the person. So, for example, there could be a fine for failing to turn on a turn signal. Say it's the point value is 3. And the income daily amount is, say, you know, $100 for one person and is $30 for another person. You would multiply 3 times 100 for that person's fine. You would multiply 3 times 30 for that person's fine. So the person with greater economic means would pay 300. The person with more limited financial means would pay 90. But they both paid something within their means, paid, and then they're done. So the entire system is different. And I do think the foundational issue is that fewer things are criminalized in Europe in general, and the court system is not a source of revenue. Here, the opposite is true. So we see so much falls within the ambit of criminal and civil legal penalties that can be abused, and then we see the revenue generation incentive that fuels the abuse by law enforcement and then the operation of the courts. And it's a cycle that we're hoping to break. And there are some innovative conversations happening right now about this exact issue of proportional fines, and how do we use this in certain jurisdictions. There were some experiments in America with this in the 90s with some limited success, and now I think there are some pilot programs that are going to be launched in America as well.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Nusrat Chowdhury, Deputy Director of the ACLU Racial Justice Program. Ms. Chowdhury's lecture was titled Modern Day Debtors' Prisons, Race and Revenue Generation in Courts Across America, and was presented by the Boston University School of Public Health. Tonight's moderator was Dr. Sandro Galea, Dean of the School of Public Health. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Matt Lissette and Renee Marchando. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.